This is David Rovics, and you are tuned to 3CR, 8:55 a.m., Melbourne, Australia. Step three is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do, and everything can change.
Welcome to the Climate Action Radio Show, which can be heard on Community Radio 3CR in Melbourne and Skid Row in Sydney. My name is Vivian Langford, and salut Babette. We'd like to pay our respects to elders past and present and pay tribute to the decades-long legacy of Aboriginal fights for land rights and against the destructive mining projects that are fueling climate change. In particular, we acknowledge the Wangan and Jagalingu cultural custodians and their ongoing opposition to coal mining on their lands in central Queensland, and to the Gomeroi traditional custodians continuing opposition to coal and gas on their land in New South Wales. It is vital at this late stage in history that we all learn to care for country. It will always be Aboriginal land, and now is our time to all stand up for and protect it.
Welcome back to the Climate Action Show. In December, I left you on a cliffhanger in Belém with the COP30 president admitting they had failed to create a roadmap for fossil fuel phase-out. He welcomed the Santa Marta conference in April as a pragmatic initiative outside the UN process, and it will be co-hosted by Colombia and the Netherlands and followed up by the Pacific nations in Tuvalu and Vanuatu. To me, this was the best news ever that we're actually going to focus on phasing out fossil fuels. How are we going to get the cooperation we need to do it? I think Colombia is unique in that it's a developing country which relies on export income from coal and oil. Yet President Petro stopped all new contracts from 2022. And like Australia, the Campaign for Climate Action here features a demand for no new coal, oil and gas contracts. You know, if we could just stop that and stop the subsidies, we could see a phase out of that dependence on fossil fuels. Coalitions of countries which are phasing out fossil fuel subsidies, like Canada, will be at the conference, as well as representatives from sectors such as Indigenous communities and frontline workers affected by the transition we want to see. It's a huge economic shift for some countries, and they need to discuss how they'll do it. What's the roadmap? Later we'll hear from Bastiaan Hassing, who is a spokesman for the Netherlands Climate Policy Minister. They have been promoting a coalition of countries who are shifting public finance to clean energy, so stopping the subsidies, basically. Australia hasn't joined yet, but we will play a big part leading up to COP31 at the end of the year. Our climate minister, Chris Bowen, will be president of negotiations, so he has a huge impact on the agenda. Meanwhile, oil-rich Venezuela and Iran have been attacked, and the sovereignty of resource-rich countries looks very fragile. So the context for this Santa Marta conference couldn't be hotter. We'll start in Johannesburg.
Today I have the wonderful Kumi Naidu with us from South Africa. He has been the head of Amnesty International and Greenpeace International, but now he is leading the push for a fossil fuel treaty. And treaties can work. Just think how Australia played a big part in the Antarctic Treaty. To this day, militarisation and mining are banned down there, so it can be done. And last year, the International Court of Justice advised that licensing and subsidising fossil fuels can be deemed illegal. So that's the context. And today we're going to talk about a big, brave conference in April in Colombia. So welcome, Kumi. First of all, tell us what it's like where you are.
Oh, today is a bit really, but I'm in Johannesburg, and it's supposedly our summer, but actually we've been getting very climate impacted weather. Yeah, it's like it feels normally this time of the year is like really hot and humid, and the weather's been really mild. Yeah, so happy to be home and been here since the Amazon COP, and yeah.
Yeah, I saw you talking to Democracy Now! There, and what a big thing that was. And I'd just like to say to listeners, the last time I produced a new program for you, I left you on a cliffhanger with that conference ending and the president of the conference saying he admitted they hadn't really created a roadmap for fossil fuels, but he endorsed the initiative from the Netherlands and the Colombian government to have a conference in April this year. So that's what I'd like to talk to you about. First of all, just place who you are to the listeners in Sydney. They will remember you were at the Climate Action Week last year, and you said we were deep in de cuck. And you said that rich countries need to pay their debt. Well, what would that look like for Australia? And please don't spare us.
So Australia is a very important country in terms of us addressing the climate crisis because it is the one of the largest fossil fuel exporters in the world. So Australia actually can produce what are called nationally determined contributions, right? Meaning that what a country is prepared to do itself to address climate. And so, yes, in South Australia, for example, 75% of energy used there now is, renewable energy. So it's a bit of a hypocritical approach to say we'll reduce our emissions domestically so we can tick off a box at the UN that we met our target, but then you're exporting huge volumes. So sadly, climate change does not exist, recognize boundaries. So whether you are emitting in Australia, whether you're exporting it to be emitted somewhere else. And so Australia's first obligation is to really get serious about what the science is saying. And let's just stop for a moment, right? And just look at why it is that we, for 30 years, have been negotiating, for more than 30 years, have been negotiating, and we don't have a solution. So we have the largest coordinated scientific enterprise in the history of humanity, which is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which has every government represented, right? And they have been saying consistently, even though their outputs tend to be more conservative because all the governments are there and they kind of try and downplay it. But even with the downplaying and even with taking a more conservative reading, they have been consistently saying we have to keep things below 1.5 degrees, we need to get off fossil fuels and so on. So why is it then that we have not made progress? So to put it in a very simple way, imagine one day you rush home to work, you were running late, and when you come back home, you open the door, you see water coming out of the bathroom, and you as you pass the kitchen, you pick up the mop and you proceed to the bathroom, you open the door and you say, "Oh, in my rush, I left the stopper in the bath, and one of the taps was leaking a bit, and over the course of the day, it had overflowed." So when you look at that situation, what do you do? Do you take the mop and start mopping first, or do you turn off the tap first? Of course, any sensible person will turn off the tap. And if 86% of the cause of what's driving climate change is our addiction and dependency on oil, coal, and gas, which the science has been telling us is driving us to destruction, then surely it does not make sense that the UN negotiating platform, UNFCCC, the main cause of climate change was only mentioned once, 2 years ago in the outcome document. Fossil fuels was mentioned because the fossil fuel lobbyists, so just to give you a sense, in the Amazon, for every 50 delegates from civil society, government, and so on, there was one delegate from the fossil fuel industry. They had in excess of thousands of folks that are holding back progress. So imagine You just to see how absurd that is, right? Imagine Alcoholics Anonymous holds a big global conference every year for 30 years, and they don't have the courage at the end of the document to mention alcohol in the outcome document. You know, it's completely absurd. And then when you look at the number of fossil fuel lobbyists at the climate conference every year, that's like Alcoholics Anonymous having a global conference on how do we get off alcohol. And then the largest delegation to the conference is the alcohol industry, right? So it's absurd. So therefore, we cannot continue to put blind faith in the UNFCCC on its own because it has not delivered what humanity needs. And that is why we are gearing up to the first international conference for the phase out of fossil fuels, which takes place at the end of April in Colombia. And so, and maybe I'll just end with this. As I was leaving Belém, I was in the same flight out of Belém as the amazing Vanuatu climate minister, Ralph Regenau. And it was 3 a.m. in the morning flight, and we were sitting there tired at the airport after 2.5 weeks of very little sleep and so on. And he said, "You know, Kumi, I am feeling more positive leaving this COP than any other COP. And the reason for that is that all the lobbying that many people did got President Lula at the opening of the climate negotiations to say, we need a fossil fuel phase out plan. And during the course of the negotiations, all the fossil fuel lobbyists were able to stop even the mention of fossil fuels. Now, it turned out that it was a good thing. That's what I mean by this. If fossil fuels was mentioned in the Belém outcome document, it would have been mentioned as weak as it was 2 years ago, or even weaker, because that's where the politics was. So the fact that it was not mentioned, it put pressure on the president of the COP, as it's called, Conference of the Parties, in the closing plenary to say, given that we've not made progress on the root cause of the problem, I might not have said it exactly the way I'm saying it, we now, as the UNFCCC and the UN process, will look at supporting the countries that are gathering in Colombia. So basically, the fact that we finally, within the formal process, got the 86% of the cause of climate change to be put at the center is very late, let's be blunt about it. And that's why onses deep in the kak, as we would say here in South Africa. It's very late, but at least we are finally starting a alternative route to actually get to a solution. And just to say to people, many people will say, oh, you know, in this current environment with Trump and the US positions and so on, a treaty would be very difficult. Just bear in mind that with the Landmine Treaty, 44 countries negotiated the treaty outside of the UN system, which is the route that we will go. And then once the treaty is signed, we bring it into the UN system, put it before the General Assembly, and say, okay, let's see which country is going to vote against the solution, which is so obvious. And so that's roughly the direction of travel. I don't want any of your listeners to think that we've won any big victory. All we've done is we've like got things back on track to give humanity a chance that we can turn things around before it's totally, totally too late. Bearing in mind, it is too late for the communities that are already losing people because of floods and droughts. You've also gone through that in Australia, and we can see there's no question that climate impacts are on the ascendancy, and we need to, as a human family, to stop being in denial that not that we're destroying the planet, but we are destroying the future of our children and their children. And that there's nothing more important than that. And let's hope that we can mobilize the moral courage to do the right thing.
Well, I have great
Took great heart to hear about this conference. It's about the best thing I've heard in all the couple of years I've been working on this. And in Australia, we've had a lot of activism against the big coal port, Newcastle. It's the biggest coal port in the world. And this is going to be held in Santa Marta, which is also a coal port in Colombia. Colombia is also a democracy, and their president has really been leaning on this, I think. I don't think he's very much reported in the Western press, but and certainly this conference, I haven't seen much reported, but I think he's a leader on this. He, when he came into power, they cancelled, or didn't cancel any contracts, but they said they won't sign any more contracts for future coal, oil, and gas extraction or export. So I've got a great deal of expectation of this, but I'd like to know from you, who is going to be there and how will you keep those fossil fuel lobbyists out? They get in everywhere and they cause delay, they kind of curdle the thinking. And as you've seen in all these conferences, UN conferences, they spoil it. So how will that conference be productive?
Firstly, I would say that I don't believe that fossil fuel lobbyists are going to find their way into that conference easily, but they can. And one of the ways they can is if, let's say, a government which has a state-owned fossil fuel company within oil, coal, or gas, then they can include somebody from that company in the delegation. So right now, we're looking at almost like a week of activity. But we must recognize, right, that climate change does not happen at something called the national level. It happens in communities. It happens where people live. It happens where local governments and state governments all have responsibility. So one track that we will have, right, that one convening. So basically, if you can imagine, on the 26th and 27th of April, that will be the culmination with ministers from, we hope, in excess of 60 countries,
Oh,
right?
that's good. Hang on. Just say
Yeah.
who you think the countries will be. Of the exporting countries like Australia, like Saudi Arabia, like Indonesia, like USA, like Russia, will they be there?
So
Canada?
right now, our focus as the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty was on those countries that accepted the science, were not in denial of how deep a crisis humanity is, and were wanting to do the right thing. So we've got already about 20 countries that have fully endorsed the idea, and they've already starting to lay the foundations for the treaty. In the cluster of countries, which is dominated by Pacific Island states and by Caribbean island states, we also have Colombia, Timor-Leste, and Pakistan, which are three fossil fuel exporting countries, who have said, yes, our economy currently depends on it, but it's a killer for our people and for the people of the world, and we have to. And that's why Colombia, for example, did not issue new contracts and so on. So, in addition to that, we have the Netherlands, we have Denmark, from Europe, we have Denmark, we hope Iceland will be there, we expect Spain would. Who endorsed our effort while we were there in the Amazon. So we will have countries from all continents, but countries that are serious about a fossil fuel phase-out plan. Now, just to be clear, this conference is not just about the treaty. It's looking about the treaty is one key part of it, but it is looking at all the things we need to do, like, for example, how do we make sure that the just transition is just, not just for the workers in the fossil fuel industry, which is important, but also for the communities? So you imagine, right, if you shut down a coal plant, we have to take care of the workers, make sure that they're retrained for new jobs in the renewable energy sector, and so on. But what about the lady who sells vegetables outside of the coal mine? What about the mechanic who fixes the cars of the people who work in the coal mine? All those small economic activity will all collapse. So therefore, when we talk about the just transition, it's about workers, absolutely, but it's also about the communities that depend on that infrastructure.
Gunnerman. This is Stephen Pigram from up Broomway, Yawuru Country, and it's great to be down in Melbourne, and you're listening to 3CR Community Radio. Been here for a long time.
Where I belong.
listening to the Climate Action Show, and Kumi Naidoo, President of the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty, is with us from Johannesburg.
So right now, Vivian, I'm not sure exactly who's going to be there, but what I know is that momentum is building, and my hope is that the number that we will have a problem where more countries than what we planned eventually say, listen, what's happening requires action, and that we would have a really powerful foundation setting event that sets the path to us finally addressing the root cause, or put differently, finally turning off the tap and stop mopping while humanity sinks.
Yes. Well, that takes us to the roadmap. And I've heard you use this analogy before, like about slavery. I think listeners should think in the 18th century, it was widely thought that if they abolished slavery, they'd have economic collapse. This is in the global north. The empires thought that. I thought it was unthinkable. It was hard for them to think how that would work, even if they deplored slavery itself, as was the case in England. But to me, the coordinated roadmap, coordinating those countries who might not be there, like Russia, like Saudi Arabia, who are heavily dependent on this fossil economy going on, to me, coordinating them on a roadmap to walk away from fossil fuels right now, it is unthinkable to me. I can't quite think what that roadmap would look like. So can you tell us what your thoughts are about what the roadmap might look like?
In an ultra-fluid world, where just outrageous things are happening, where the President of the United States is talking about annexing Greenland, annexing Canada, irrespective of what they say about Venezuela. Venezuela, I mean, you have to be really kind of closing your eyes not to think it's all about oil. You know, it's just about oil. I mean, Venezuela is not importing cocaine and fentanyl and so on. It's all coming from Mexico. So there's the, you know, it's, and you can see, I mean, thankfully, President Trump is unable to hide the deviousness of his decisions, right? Understand that a lot of things you might think today, we have a plan, and then Trump goes and invades Venezuela, and then you can't pretend that that didn't happen. You have to factor that into your thinking, and also to understand that what Venezuela shows, what the US did in Venezuela shows why we need to get off fossil fuels, which is another reason that a lot of our conflicts in the world historically have been driven by the extractive impulse of the global north countries to dominate them because they had the technology and so on. And I think that time is changing. And Australia historically, together with New Zealand, played a very important role with the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And one of the things that happened was bottom-up pressure, where cities across the world, but Australia and New Zealand were quite kind of one of the strongest countries, where cities were declaring themselves nuclear-free zones, right? And so cities now are, even in the United States, by the way, the state government of California, Maine, and Hawaii have endorsed the treaty, as well as cities like Philadelphia, San Francisco, Pittsburgh, many cities. So building pressure from below is what will make it difficult for the Australian government, for example, to say, we are key players in the COP come Turkey. Yes. They have to be there. They have to be there in Colombia. I mean, we're not forcing anybody to come, right? But ethically, morally, and so on, I would say Australia needs to be there, but I think the people of Australia needs to give a strong encouragement to the government of Australia at the moment to be in as part of the process of phasing out fossil fuels, because that's the key part of the solution. And you cannot say we are the co-convener of the COP in Turkey, but, oh, by the way, there's this meeting which is addressing the real cause of the crisis, and we're not going to go. So
3CR is powered by people like you. No ads, no corporate control, just raw, real radio created by the community for the community. So what are you waiting for? Show your solidarity today. Subscribe to 3CR and help us keep the airways free for voices that matter.
Could I just go back to the idea that you said, if you build it, they'll come. There's something about that. If you build an idea, it becomes thinkable that we can transition the global economy away from these fossil fuels, even though it's suicidal to go on using them. That doesn't seem to come into the equation. I don't think countries like Australia, Russia, Indonesia, USA, I don't think they will come to the thing you have built and without looking over their shoulder to see if the others aren't coming too, because they'll lose commercial advantage. We subsidize in Australia our fossil fuels, and all over the world they do. I think Netherlands has got a thing about initiatives to people to sign up not to have initiatives, give initiatives to those fossil fuels. And Canada, which is a big exporter, has signed that, but Australia hasn't signed that either. We still subsidize. So I think they'll be looking over their shoulder. If you build it, will they come if the other guy doesn't come? I want you to explain how we could make it thinkable for them to come, for them to see the self-interest and common interest in the whole global economy transitioning away.
So this is such a great question. And the answer to this is the answer to most questions. And that is the answer, you know, community is always the right answer. And community, by what I mean, when I said trade unions push, let's keep it in Australia, right? Trade unions are already more and more engaged in pushing for climate justice. They say correctly, there are no jobs on a dead planet, and therefore climate change has to be an agenda of working people. Local governments, state governments adding their voice, and so on. But countries will go, governments will go to this if their people tell them, you need to go to this. Because if you're not going, then you are not representing my interests. And what you describe, by the way, Vivian, is absolutely what's going to happen, right? But when they're looking behind the back, they must not only be looking to see which other governments are agreeing. When they look behind their back, they must see their people saying go, right? And the way they see that is by building pressure from below. And a lot of what the treaty has done in the last 4 years is actually building the momentum from below. Because you can imagine when we first started talking about this, I joined as a champion in the early days of the treaty. And I know very people say, oh my God, good idea, great idea. But oh my God, who will you get to join it? And yeah, I want to pay tribute to the leaders of the Pacific, to Minister Mena in Tuvalu, to Minister Ralph Reginau in Vanuatu. The Fiji has been great. Basically, almost every country in the Pacific has been in the forefront. And by the way, the conference, and let me say this, if the Prime Minister or any of his government is listening to this, I will say this to them very nicely. You were planning to do a Pacific COP, and you got the UNFCCC to agree, and you were going to do it in partnership with the Pacific nations that are your immediate neighbors. Right now, the conference is in Colombia, but it is jointly coordinated and convened by Netherlands, Colombia, and Tuvalu sits in the planning committee as a representative of the Pacific Island states. So I want to say to the Prime Minister of Australia and to the leadership of Australia, imagine how bad it looks when your neighbors, who are most vulnerable of almost any nations anywhere in the world, are asking you to join them to seek the solution that in your heart, if it's not in your heart, then it should be in your head, because your scientists have told you in Australia and elsewhere that you are not with the program. So imagine how bad it would be if Australia did not indicate early that, yes, we will attend, we will participate. We have a role coming up later in the year in Turkey as part of the convening of the next COP. given all of that, I make an appeal to the people of Australia to put pressure on the Australian government to do the right thing, be part of the conversation, and understand that the longer you continue to be wedded to a dependency for your economy on fossil fuels, you are stuck in the past and you're part of the problem. But yet, Australia has one of the biggest potentials to be a renewable energy leader in the world. And I say to the economists in Australia, to correct me if I'm wrong, but the longer the Australian government drags its feet and does not do the transition to a economy that's driven by clean, green, renewable energy rather than an economy that's driven on fossil fuels, they will put, those governments are putting their economic future at risk. Let me just say, even Donald Trump. Donald Trump's policies are going to decimate the US economy, and you can see signs of that happening already. And so my appeal to the Australian people, put maximum pressure as soon as you can on your government and ask them to go to Colombia to represent your interests and to be part of the real conversation that can deliver a durable outcome to the threat of climate change.
Well, if they're not listening, I will be sending them the podcast so they get your words. Now, the last question is about violence, and you've made many comments about how peace is connected with climate action. And this recent violent grab for oil in Venezuela and the history of wars over resources, not just fossil fuels now, but critical minerals, but and in our near neighbour East Timor, it should be in every Australian's mind that, you know, they were struggling against a grab for their oil. And Australia has been part of that grab. They're our nearest neighbour. So it makes me rather sick to think about what people will do for this resource. The conclusion is that countries can't go it alone. They have to be coordinated. It has to be a block of countries who resist this, who stand up for, you know, the rights and the legality and the International Court of Justice and all of those sort of guidelines which would keep all of us safe. What are your thoughts about preventing this sort of continuation of a history of wars over oil, coal, and gas, facing up to the vested interests, these corporations that capture governments all over the world?
Let me answer this in a somewhat light way, even though it's such a heavy question. In the run-up to the US illegal invasion of Iraq, that war became known as Operation Iraqi Freedom. That's how the media and the US military establishment framed it. But actually, there's a joke that goes around saying, actually, you know what? It was called Operation Iraqi Liberation first, and then they changed. And then someone said, "Oh my God, Operation O, Iraqi I, Liberation L." We don't want to be so obvious and spell that that was about oil, right? You know, in Africa, we say we are the richest continent underneath the ground. That's why we are the precisely the poorest continent above the ground, right? Because our resources are extracted by powerful countries in the global north. And in some corrupt leadership elements on our continent benefit from it, but the majority of our people don't. So fossil fuels has never served ordinary people. It has been a source of violence. And how do we get out of it? We get out of a dependency on a energy system that has historically and presently fueled war and conflict. The last thing I would say is the US invasion of Venezuela is the expected outcome of an energy system built on extraction, colonization, and violence, which does expose the truth that the fossil fuel economy is inseparable from imperialism, militarization, and instability. So, given all of that, we need to understand that the invasion of Venezuela by the United States is a unilateral act of war and regime change against a sovereign nation. That doesn't mean I or anybody else necessarily supports the historical actions of the Maduro regime. But, you know, if you are so concerned about democracy, start in Saudi Arabia and go and look at the people who killed the journalist Khashoggi in the most brutal manner and many other human rights violations. So we must build peace by looking at what peace, our energy system should be aligned to peace and reduction of conflict. And renewable energies is a decentralized way of energy provision, which makes it hard to have the kind of monopolistic control that you have by individual companies. And the solution for me is very simple. Make the transition from our addiction to fossil fuels to clean energies as fast as possible. And the good news is the technology is there, the knowledge is there. We have what we know what we need to do. All that is missing is political will, because the fossil fuel industry sadly controls the decision making of many of our governments, including the Australian government.
Yeah, thank you very much. That was Kumi Naidu, who is a really wonderful speaker and an inspiration, as you've heard, Amnesty International, so human rights, environment through Greenpeace. So he's an activist from way back, absolutely a veteran of activism and people power, I would think. So I'd love to thank you, Kumi, for spending this time with our listeners.
Did you know that Western Sahara is Africa's last colony? The issue of Western Sahara was raised in the Eddie Mabo case referencing Terra Nullius. Western Sahara is illegally occupied by Morocco. Indigenous Sahrawis are denied their right to self-determination. France continues to veto United Nations human rights observation in Western Sahara. Sahrawi people are being killed by Israeli drones. Like to learn more? Become informed. Become an Australia Western Sahara Association member at awsa.org.au. Australian Western Sahara Association is a 3CR supporter.
The Santa Marta Conference will hear from frontline communities. Some are protecting forests from oil drilling in the Amazon, for example. And here in Australia, the Wangan and Jagalingu people are protecting their sacred waters from the encroachments of the Adani Brabus coal mine. Here is our own Garajula on the 28th of January, when we heard the exciting news from the Supreme Court that it is allowing their case against the Queensland government. He's speaking about the coal giants that we are up against.
We're dealing with some of the most savage people that have ever roamed this earth. So the only way to meet the most savage is to dance around them with a smile on your face. You have to have a smile on your face, because they will try to burn you out, and that's the one thing that they're really good at. Running protracted wars to burn you out, so then you just walk away.
From The Hague, here is Bastiaan Hassing. He is the program lead for the Netherlands at the Santa Marta Summit in Colombia. And he's a veteran of many climate negotiations. I'm very delighted he can give us a little bit of his background knowledge and plans for the future.
Thank you very much, Vivian. Thank you for having me. And why are we willing to co-host a conference? I think we were very pleasantly surprised by the momentum that we saw happening at COP30 in Belém around the topic of fossil fuel phase out. Now, Colombia had already in September announced they would organize a conference on the topic. We have been leading a small coalition of countries working on phasing out fossil fuel subsidies.
Yes.
So these topics logically merge together, and seeing such a group, such a big group of countries willing to discuss this further, it seemed like a logical thing to do.
So Colombia said there will be dialogues leading up, you know, the conference is at the end of April, but leading up to there'll be dialogues with all sorts of society. I've seen a few webinars on it. Sectors like civil society, indigenous people, workers affected by transition, academics, you know, to give expert information, they'll all contribute. But how will these dialogues be guided into a roadmap I imagine you have expertise in this. You know, it's like a Tower of Babel, and then you try to settle it into something that you can take action on.
Well, yes, that's correct. We aim to have a very inclusive conference. What we are now trying to figure out is how exactly to channel all of the interest from all of the different sectors, make sure that it will be sort of like a balanced representation of civil society, but also private sector, academia, think tanks, and all that. The conference will be in April, so we have a bit of time to figure that out.
I look at the COPs on as much as I can from here online, you know, all these various panels, and I think, oh my gosh, how does it ever then consolidate into an outcome, you know, or anything that people can take action? And people are very jaded and disappointed in the COP system, mainly because there's too many fossil people there. Even the Australian Pavilion last time, I think it had Santos written right across the Australian Pavilion. It just feels terrible. But I want to know, this conference is different. It's outside the United Nations framework. It's a conference of the willing. It's people who really are committed to this who will be there. How are you going to guide them? Very sincere people, people who all take all sorts of aspects on the problem. How is this going to be? Is it going to be put into a report, or how will it be given to the people who then debate it on the 28th and 29th of April?
Yes, exactly. Well, what you say is quite recognizable, of course, with your characterization of discussions that we have at COP. So the aim for this conference will be to have a more of a working conference with indeed those countries that are willing to take actual steps to transition away from fossil fuels. And we want it to be small, intimate, interactive, so there can be an actual back and forth explaining what they're doing in their own country or what problems they face. How can we learn from each other? How can we increase effectiveness through international cooperation? So that's going to be on the 28th and the 29th of April. Because of the massive interest from let's say, non-country, non-government stakeholders, there is going to be space for others to organize themselves on the 24th and the 25th of April, also in Santa Marta, Colombia, where on around the same topics, excuse me, they can have their own conversations. Our idea is that they then appoint one or two representatives who feed back the results of those conversations to the ministers on the 28th and the 29th.
Yeah. Well, I think Netherlands has quite a good reputation in this. I remember we had the Urgenda case and we had a speaker out here. I had the impression that Netherlands really has some expertise in pushing either the judicial system or the economic system or, you know, the levers of this big transition. It's almost unthinkable to many people that it could happen. You know, we just feel, you know, people say, oh, they can think of the end of the world easier than they can think of the end of capitalism, in other words, the economic system. So I think Netherlands is well placed. I'm very glad you're lending your expertise to Colombia. It gives it that sort of European background.
Well, you're very kind in saying that. I think we can learn a lot from Colombia as well. I think in general, the discussion about a fossil fuel phase out centers around two extremes of the spectrum, where on the one side, people say, you're not going fast enough, you need to go faster, or, you know, the world's going to end. And the other side of the spectrum says, look, this is all way too costly. You're going to ruin our economy. Just forget about it. And I think there are many reports out there. There are many knowledgeable institutions and think tanks who have shown that if we do this right, we can make the world a better place and make our economies grow. So we also need to figure out how to build on the information that's already out there, learn from those who have successfully taken first steps. And that's what this conference is about.
Yeah, well, Colombia has taken those first steps. Exactly. I'm just waiting for them to be invaded or something dreadful happening to them, but they've taken those steps. They've stopped new fossil fuel projects, and Australia can't do that yet. We're really watching this with great interest, like how do you do it without everything collapsing? And I'm interested in the countries whose economy is dependent on fossil fuel exports, not just the internal emissions, but the externalized emissions. And of the top six, I've looked down on the list of those ones who worked with your coalition who don't want, who are planning to phase out subsidies. Well, only Canada out of that top six of big exporters is signing on to that. Australia is not. And I want to know, what has the Netherlands learned about building coalitions? Like, how do you persuade people that their economy won't collapse, that you understand what, you know, it's not to be criticizing people whose economy has ended up being so fossil fuel dependent. It's a big profit for some, but it's death for the rest of us, you know, ultimately. So planetary death, let's say.
I mean, this is such a delicate topic where everyone has a strong opinion, also in the political debate, that for us, I think it's very important to be able to create a safe space for governments to be open about the difficulties that they face. I think that's the main takeaway that we've learned.
And so are you hoping at that Santa Marta conference some countries will come who are just interested, who are putting a toe in the water, who haven't yet committed even to phasing out subsidies? Are you hoping they'll be there, or is it only the people who are already committed will be there?
We have sent invitations to countries who have signaled willingness to work on a transition away in one form or another. So it's not all about subsidies. It's you know, countries working on different elements of the transition. This is, of course, a first conference, and we're very confident that one of the outcomes will be that there will be a second conference. Now, you mentioned Australia's role in the upcoming COP. We also hope that we can, at the next COP, bring back some of the things that we've learned during this conference that might apply also to other countries. So that hopefully at a second conference, the group will be bigger.
That's right. Well, Australia, we signed the Belém Declaration at COP30 in the Amazon. And our climate minister, Chris Bowen, will be president of the negotiations at COP31. And listeners might not be up to speed on what that really means, but I think it's different from being COP president, but president of negotiations does a lot of work in the interim and goes around the country and creates the agenda. And this will be in agreement with the Pacific countries who were going to be our co-partner if we were hosting it. And Chris Baum's pretty committed to getting them on side. So what do you have to say to him? If you were speaking directly to him, or he came and asked you in a safe way to give your frank opinion, what would you say to him? And also, what would you say to climate campaigners who are thinking, how can we pressure our government? Where should we put our energy in this context regarding, you know, leading up to Santa Marta? What would be a good use of our energy? But also, Chris Bowen, should he be there? What should he do in setting the agenda?
Well, first of all, I want to wish him the best of luck, because presiding over a climate conference is no small feat. So I know he will have his hands full, as you say, mostly focusing on the negotiations. One of the things we are thinking about, and it will in part depend on the outcome of the conference, is how to bring back the results of our Santa Marta conference to the next COP. There are different ways of doing that. The easy way would be to have the two co-hosting ministers report back in a high-level discussion. A more complex way of doing that is to have some of the recommendations that we hope to produce be part of a COP decision. That would mean that that all countries participating in the COP would have to agree, which is a much more difficult task, as you are surely aware. So, yes, we are looking forward to working with Minister Bowen and his team to see what their priorities are, or how they see the next COP focusing on. And discuss with them how we can inform the debate.
And and to the activists, because the listeners to this program, it's called the Climate Action Show. I don't think Chris Bowen is listening to it, and I don't think a lot of people would want to listen to it, but the activists do, because they want to know, well, who's taking action, where's the action going? What would you say to them? I know it's quite active in Netherlands. You have a lot of Extinction Rebellion get reported, but I know there's a lot of community groups acting in Netherlands to push this sort of rapid change we need, and it shouldn't. I don't think I should have to apologize for it either anymore. I feel I'm always apologizing for the community activists in a sort of way, but really they're the ones who are the heart and soul of it, aren't they? Otherwise things would go so slowly, it wouldn't happen. We've had 30 COPs and we haven't had, you know, an agreement to phase out fossil fuels, not even an agreement to stop subsidies. 30 COPs. So really we need the ginger groups in the society, don't you? What do you say to them?
We've had 30 COPs, the majority not even mentioning fossil fuels. No. So we certainly need outside support and pressure on governments to start taking actions. They certainly have a role to play. And we also see demonstrations by Extinction Rebellion and other groups calling on the governments to take action, to start phasing out fossil fuel subsidies and yes, to start phasing out fossil fuels. So like I said, we're certainly looking to engage with all parties and all sectors of society, including having discussions with these groups.
But what works? What do you think they should do? You know, that what gets through in your experience? You've been in this world for a little while, a few years.
Yeah. I work for the government, so I don't think it's my place to tell them what works and what doesn't work. I think what we see happening is that in different parts of civil society, there's a strong call to do something about fossil fuels, not just from activist groups, also actually from private sector parties who are already working on the transition, they're transforming their businesses. So having different voices of society call for the same ultimate goal is for governments and politicians, I think, quite helpful.
Yeah. Okay, so in summary, at the summit, there'll be governments and they are from the countries who are committed to the transition. So they're the fair dinkum, we say in Australia, fair dinkum governments who really are prepared to work on this. But I notice in the list, a lot of them are people who don't, countries that don't have fossil fuels, who are working hard to get their emissions down, but it's not a big issue for them to phase out, you know, the big export of fossil fuels. So it's not really about that. It's just about phasing out maybe the use of fossil fuels. Is it the decarbonisation of society? So they're the countries that are doing that. And they will be informed by these dialogue groups from civil society and other sectors. So just in your anticipation, I know it's a few months beforehand, but what do you think the roadmap they come up with, what will that roadmap look like? What would you like it to look like?
Well, I think the word roadmap might be confusing because there was a call during COP30 in Belém, and at the end of the conference, we didn't manage to agree on having a roadmap, yet the Brazilians afterwards did announce that they will be working on one. So I want to be clear that our Santa Marta conference will not necessarily produce a roadmap. You're correct in saying that it's going to be a mix of countries, some having fossil fuel production, other looking at it more from the consumer side. And those are two of the three tracks we want to focus on. How can you diversify your economy if it right now it depends to a large extent on the production of fossil fuels? At the same time, if you are dependent on the import of fossil fuels, what can you do in that situation to transition away? And the third track would be, how can we increase international cooperation and, as I said before, learn from each other and help each other in that respect?
And what about the subsidies? That's the other strand that the Netherlands took an initiative on. What do you feel about that now?
That would fall under the second pillar. So from the consumption side, subsidies in general are meant to compensate for high prices. Taking them away will touch on someone's income, either a private person or a business. And both a subsidy and a fossil fuel can only be transitioned away from if there's an affordable alternative available.
Yeah. Well, there is in this case, isn't there? In Australia, we've had many reports published on Australia, the renewable energy superpower. We have abundant renewable energy resources, you know, and the technology for it.
So for energy production and consumption, there's renewable energy. The question is, are we talking about potential or are we actually already on the way to implementing that?
Yes.
I think that's going to be a big part of the discussion in Santa Marta. If you want to go there, what steps do you need to take?
Oh, well, good luck. I won't be there, but I'm certainly wanting to report on it when it's happened. I'd like to finish with a comment by Colombia's environment minister. I was hoping to speak to her, but I think she's probably really too busy at the moment. But I'd love to speak to her, Irene Vélez Torres, and she's been giving a lot of interviews. And she said, "We are more sovereign if we are less dependent on exports that are carbon intensive." And she said this after Venezuela was attacked by USA and their president was abducted, you know, oil-rich Venezuela right next to oil-rich Colombia. And she just said, "We're probably better off if we're not exporting it and we are facing out our exports." So do you have anything to add regarding this sort of scenario of the connection between wars and, you know, fossil fuels, which we've lived through? Do you have anything to add for countries who are considering the phase out, first of fossil subsidies and then of extractive contracts, when they think of the potential of losing their sovereignty? Could you talk a bit about that, given the history?
Well, I think what we unfortunately see happening now in the world is that there are many different reasons to move away from the use of fossil fuels. We've been so far mostly talking about it from a climate perspective, but I agree with Minister Vélez Torres that energy security or energy independence is an equally important part of it. We have seen that in Europe with the war in Ukraine and our dependence on Russian gas. So there are several benefits from moving away from imports or exports of fossil fuels and being able to produce at least part of your own supply and demand.
I think there's a very volatile time, so I'm very grateful to you to be part of that conference where, as you said, you'll create a space, a safe space, where a lot of things can be teased out. There's such a lot to be said. You'd think everything that could be said will be said at the COP, but it obviously hasn't. And this is a separate one. To me, it's very innovative. It was the best thing I heard about, you know, when I heard that was announced. I think that's the way we want to go. Those are the people we want to hear from. Perhaps not instant result, not a treaty or a promise, but something that can feed into the next COP that's a bit more based in the reality. So thank you very much. Any last words to us, to the people in Australia?
Well, I'm very excited about this project. I hope we can live up to the expectations.
Thank you. So we've been speaking to Mr. Bastiaan Hassing. He's from the Netherlands government. I'd also like to thank Peter den Bruggenkater, who helped me get this interview. Thank you for exploring this subject with us. I'm sure there'll be a lot more to say after the conference. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
When you compare an old growth forest compared to a forest which is regrowing after a disturbance like logging, they're actually quite different ecosystems. Generally, like older, wetter forests slow down the path of fire, and this is actually quite a well-known phenomenon. Historically, these big, large fires have been quite rare, but what we've seen in the last 20 years is they're becoming quite a lot more common. So we've had 3 in the last 20 years. This is definitely because of climate change, which is making our ecosystems a lot drier and the fire weather more intense.
We need to keep radical voices on air. Subscribe now.
Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 9419 8377.
Thanks for taking this all in, dear listeners. Our guests today were Kumi Naidu and Bastiaan Hassing,
both of whom will be at the first international conference to focus on phasing out coal, oil and gas in Colombia. I hope to bring you more speakers before April, but please urge our government to go to Colombia and participate in this most important conference. My name is Vivian Langford. Goodbye and good luck.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared. It's coal. It's coal.
Tune in every Monday at 5 p.m. to hear the Climate Action Radio Show.